to The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Willett, and this episode's guest is John Kessel. Welcome to another episode of The World Shapers, where I talk to science fiction and fantasy authors about their creative process. My name is Edward Willett. I am your genial, I hope, host. And I'm also a science fiction and fantasy author. And in fact, this is a special week for me because this is going live on September 8th. And on September 10th, Tuesday, my latest novel, Master of the World, my 10th novel for New York's Daw Books, comes out. It's book two in my World Shaper series, from which this podcast also takes its name. Book one, World Shaper, came out last September in trade paperback, and the mass market paperback just came out in August, so it's out there on the shelves for you to find as well. The series takes place in what I call the labyrinth. These are worlds, sort of a maze of interconnected worlds. All of these worlds were shaped by someone who lives within them, shapers. And so they can be anything. It's very much like the authors that I interview on this program, living inside their own worlds. In the first book, Shauna Keyes, my main character, discovered that she was a shaper, which she had forgotten, but she had to flee her shaped world, which was very much like ours, but not quite, because an adversary, an enemy, had appeared who's trying to basically take over the labyrinth and eventually snuff out all of these shaped worlds in order to get to Ygritte, who's the mysterious woman at the center of the labyrinth. Carl Yatzer shows up in Shauna's world in the first book and tells her what's going on and guides her out of her world, and also says that she has the power to gather the knowledge of all these shaped worlds, or as many as she can get to, and take them to Ygritte in the hopes of saving them and the labyrinth from the adversary. So that's kind of the overarching quest of the book. So each book will take place in a very different kind of a world, and book two actually takes place in, as you might guess from the title, a world that is inspired by Jules Verne. The shaper of this world really liked Jules Verne, so it's full of airships and submarines and all sorts of great things like that. It's had good reviews so far from Publishers Weekly and Booklist, and others are starting to pop up, and I hope you'll check it out. It's available now in trade paperback, audiobook, and ebook formats. You can find it through your favorite online bookshop, hopefully in your physical bookstore close to you, or you can order it direct from me if you like through my online store, edwardwillettshop.com. If you want to get an autographed copy, that's the best way to do that. The other thing that I want to mention, because this is going out on September the 8th, is that next Saturday, September the 14th, at 11:59 Eastern Daylight Time, p.m., is the deadline for voting for Canada's Aurora Awards. These are the awards that are given out annually by the Canadian Science Fiction and Fantasy Association. They are voted on by fans, and they are for the best Canadian science fiction and fantasy. And I'm very honored that this year the World Shapers podcast is up for an Aurora Award in the category of Best Fan-Related Work. If you go over to priauroraawards.ca, that's priauroraawards.ca, priauroraawards.ca, you can join for a mere $10 the Canadian Science Fiction and Fantasy Association, which gives you the right to vote for this year's Auroras and access the voters package. You only have a week. If you're hearing this on the day it comes out, and if it's after September the 8th, then I'm afraid you're too late this time around, but you can still join and nominate and vote next year, provided, of course, that you are a Canadian citizen or resident. The other thing that I wanted to mention is that I'm starting a term as the writer-in-residence at the Saskatoon Public Library this coming week. It's a very busy week for me. If you are listening to this in Saskatoon or environs, please come see me. If you have questions about writing, would like me to help you with your writing, or answer questions you might have about publishing, you can contact me through the Saskatoon Public Library. Okay, so I think that's it for all the stuff I want to talk about myself this time. So let's get on to this week's guest, John Kessel. John Kessel's most recent book is the 2018 novel Pride and Prometheus. He's the author of the earlier novels, The Moon and the Other, Good News from Outer Space, and Corrupting Dr. Nice, and in collaboration with James Patrick Kelly, Freedom Beach. His short story collections are Meeting in Infinity, a New York Times notable book, The Pure Product, and The Baum Plan for Financial Independence. Kessel stories have twice received the Nebula Award given by the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, in addition to the Theodore Sturgeon Memorial Award, the Locust Pole, and the James Tiptree Jr. Award. His play Faust Feathers won the Paul Green Playwrights Prize, and his story A Clean Escape was adapted as an episode of the ABC TV series Masters of Science Fiction. In 2009, his story Pride and Prometheus, on which the novel is based, received both the Nebula Award and the Shirley Jackson Award. With Jim Kelly, he has edited 5 anthologies of stories revisioning contemporary short SF, most recently Digital Rapture, the Singularity Anthology. Born in Buffalo, New York, John holds a BA in Physics and English and a PhD in American Literature. He helped found and served as the first director of the MFA program in creative writing at North Carolina State University, where he has taught since 1982. And he and his wife, the novelist Teresa Ann Fowler, live and work in Raleigh, North Carolina. So welcome to the World Shapers, John.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Now, we've never met in person, but the way you ended up on this show, I've been aware of your name for a long time, obviously, with your record, it's, you know, and being in the field. But I've never run across you at a convention or anything like that. But Christopher Rocchio, who was a guest on the program a little while ago, was one of your students, and he mentioned your name, and I thought, you know, I should have him on.
Well, I'm glad you had him on. You know, Christopher seems to be well-launched now with his first novel, and I guess the second novel in that series is coming out. Is that right?
Yeah, just came out. Doing very well. And he's a fellow DAW books author, so I'd met him at a DAW dinner at WorldCon last year, so that's how we made that connection. So it's in this field, you know somebody, and then they know somebody, and everybody's connected.
It's, even though it's much bigger than it was when I started, it's still a fairly small pond, and you will run into people, and everyone eventually knows everyone else in some connection.
Yep. Well, we'll start the way I always start, which is by taking you back into the mists of time to find out how you became interested in science fiction fantasy and specifically in writing it. Most of us, it starts with reading as kids. Is that how it worked out for you?
Pretty much, yes. I was reading science fiction and fantasy from the beginning. I cannot remember the first book I ever read that was science fiction. There were children's books, and I was born a long time ago. I was born in 1950. So we're talking, you know, late 50s, early 60s. I was definitely already hooked on science fiction and fantasy. I liked fairy tales an awful lot. And then I went to the library and got books from the science fiction section of the library. And back then they had a number of publishers had fairly serious attempts to write published YA science fiction, and Robert Heinlein wrote a series of juvenile novels that I really snarfed up. And also Andre Norton, who was Alice Mary Norton, wrote a whole series of YA science fiction novels that I loved. It was quite a shock to me when I discovered that Andre Norton was a woman. Was years later, and then around, I think it was 1963. Pretty much exactly when it was. I was at my grandfather's house on a Sunday, and I had my library book there, and I finished it, and I had nothing else to read, and I was bored, and I asked if I could go down the block. This is in Buffalo, New York, to see if I could buy some comic books. And they said, okay. And so I walked down to this delicatessen, Cosentino's Delicatessen, and they had some comic books, but they also had science fiction magazines, which I had never seen. And I knew they existed, but I had never seen one. And immediately I bought my first science fiction magazines. And then I was well and truly hooked. Pretty much I had subscriptions to Galaxy and Fantasy and Science Fiction and Analog starting in the early 60s. So I was really much pretty much a science fiction nerd from day one.
Well, it's interesting because I'm a little bit younger than you. I was born in 59. But that's exactly my list of books that got me interested in it is Heinlein and Andre Norton. Somehow I knew Andre Norton was a woman. I don't know. I don't remember ever being surprised to find it out. So I must have read a bio or something of her early on and knew
that. I think it became much more public knowledge by the late 60s. But up until the mid 60s, I think, you know, she basically kept her identity close to the vest.
It was James Tiptree Jr. I was surprised to find.
Yes, right. Me too, really.
Yeah, well, by the time I was reading her, it would have been the late 60s, so that's probably why I knew it from the beginning. But that's sort of the same list of things that I had became interested in as well. So when did you start trying your hand at writing?
Well, you know, I often tell students and my writing students that one of the seven warning signs that you might become a writer is that you are writing fiction, which is not on command by your English teacher, before the age of 10. And indeed, I was writing stories, and I actually made a little magazine. I sort of would compel my friends to write them, and I would illustrate the stories myself. Probably, maybe I was 11 or 12. So I was trying to do that. And I remember there was a contest in fantasy and science fiction in the mid 60s that asked for submissions. And I submitted an entry there, and I got my first rejection slip, and I still have it. And so I was at it pretty early. I was, you know, in my early teens when I submitted my first story. I didn't ever submit another story until I was in college. But, you know, I knew that there was the possibility of an ordinary person writing stories and sending them off. And it was really quite, I felt empowered by the fact that they had sent me a rejection slip. The idea that I, you know, John Kessel, kid from Buffalo, New York, could write a story and send it into the magazine and they would read it and say no, but they would send me a slip just as if I were, you know, a published writer. And so that was cool.
Yeah, I remember that same feeling. My first published story, though, was actually at about that age. I actually got a story published in something called Young Authors Open in Cat Fancy Magazine.
Wow.
And it was a terrible, terrible pun about a Santa Claus looking for a replacement. And he searched the world over and he found this guy he thought was perfect, but the guy wouldn't weed his garden. And he knew he couldn't be Santa Claus because he wouldn't ho, ho, ho. That was the.
Well, you know, it's funny because my first submission to FNSF was what was called a feg hoot. It ended with.
Oh, I remember those. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
So were you focused on short fiction entirely? Did you try your hand at longer stuff during those early years?
Pretty much short fiction. I really loved short stories, still do. And so that was my thing, was short fiction. Although I read a lot of novels, I'd never tried to write one till I was in my 20s and late 20s and really had to learn. I mean, novels are different from short stories. So, and I don't think the short story is a less important form, although, you know, in terms of making a living, certainly it's hard to do writing short fiction. So, but I think artistically the short story is a beautiful form, and it's not a practice for the novel. It's not a less worthy or less important form, but it is different.
Yeah. Somewhere on my bookshelf right behind me, I was just turning around to look, is a collection of science fiction short stories from one of those anthologies from the late 50s or early 60s. And the short fiction was sort of my introduction to it. And that's certainly the way I started writing it as well. But it turns out I'm more of a novelist, I think, and a short story writer. Did you show your stories? You said you had this little magazine. Were you letting people read your stories?
My friends were not, they were not as interested in this as I was. So I just, you know, it was just my thing. At that stage anyway, when I'm talking about junior high school or middle school. I didn't really advertise them to people.
I usually ask that because when I'm teaching writing, and I know you're much more of a writing teacher than I am, but I often recommend to people that they do let other people read their work because it's a way to find out if you can tell stories that people are interested in.
Well, I think ultimately you do have to submit the story to an audience, either an audience of, you know, teacher or mentor or other writers. And so I've actually been very active in workshopping. I like workshopping, and not just as a teacher in the university, but I was invited to one of the last Milford workshops run by Ed Bryant in 1980 and then again in 81. And that was a real revelatory experience for me in 1980 because I met these other writers, many of them up and coming writers, but also and they were most of them unknown. Among the writers who were at this first workshop I went to were Ed Bryant, who was well established at that point, and one is sort of a writing hero of mine, although people don't remember him.
I remember
so
the
much
name
anymore.
Yeah.
But then. Connie Willis was there. She only published a few stories. Cynthia Felice, one of the other people there who had not published a single story at that point, who was one of the workshop members, was Dan Simmons. Mm. And George R. R. Martin was one of the writers there. So I got to know these people really early, and it was really heartening that they would read my stories and give me critiques. So that was good.
Well, when you went to university, where did you go to university?
I went as an undergraduate to the University of Rochester, New York. And it's a small private school, and I studied astrophysics. I wanted to be an astronomer. And then I double majored by the time I graduated. It was a degree in physics and English.
What drew you out of astrophysics to add the English?
Probably you could say that tensor calculus had something to do with it. I could do the math pretty well through the first couple of years, but by the time it got to the really higher math and the higher physics too, is tremendously mathematical, especially it was at that time where I think the slogan was, you know, shut up and calculate that in physics. And so I had to struggle to do the really advanced math. And I could see other physics majors around me. And there were it's a small group of physics majors. Maybe there were 20 in my graduating class. Some of them could do it much better and with more facility, more naturally than I could. So, and I also saw that my GPA in English classes, which I was taking for fun, was like a grade point higher than my math class grades. So I thought, well, and I'm enjoying the English classes, I'll double major. I didn't know what exactly I was going to do at that point, but I know I loved reading, and I at that point was starting to write stories again. And so I took my first creative writing class on my second semester senior year at Rochester, and wrote a science fiction story for my final project there. And so I was getting more serious about that. And then I went to graduate school at the University of Kansas in Lawrence, Kansas. And the main reason I went there was that there was a science fiction writer on the faculty there, James Gunn, mm-hmm. who's still alive, 96 years old, I believe, and was he's a grandmaster of SFWA. And so he was my mentor there. I was in his classes, and he was on. He directed my master's thesis, which was in fiction writing, and then on my PhD dissertation, I persuaded the university to let me write a collection of stories rather than a scholarly work for my PhD in American Lit. And so, I wrote a bunch of stories, and he was also on my committee at that point. So
were those science fiction fantasy stories?
They all were. And one of them in my dissertation was Another Orphan, which won the Nebula Award in 1982. Mm. So I guess I was glad I was able to do that. I mean, I was writing anyway. I would have written the stories anyway, but I probably wouldn't have finished my dissertation if I had had to write a scholarly dissertation, because I knew at that point, although I'm very interested in, literary study, and I've taught American Lit for 30, almost 40 years. But I really wasn't interested in writing books about, canonical writers and, being a scholar. I wanted to write fiction. So most of my energy went there.
Well, this is, it's interesting to me that I ask most authors about their, if they had any formal creative writing training, and you get a really mixed bag with science fiction and fantasy authors. There are some who did it and it was not a particularly good experience for them because they met so right. much pushback against writing science fiction fantasy. Fortunately, you found James Gunn.
Right.
Was he the only one teaching at that level at that time?
Well, there were very few. I think the only one I can think of, this is 1972 when I went to grad school, is Jack Williamson, who was teaching, I think, at the University of New Mexico.
Right.
I don't know if he was a regular faculty member or not, and I didn't even know he was teaching there. So the only one I knew about was gone, and that's why I went there. So I guess you could say that that was instrumental there, that he did not turn up his nose at my writing science fiction. And I'm very aware of what you say, that many creative writing teachers, at least in the past, have been very skeptical of anyone who wants to write genre fiction in a literary workshop.
Do you think that's changing?
I think it's changing to a degree. It depends on what kind of genre fiction you write now. If you write a story with aliens and spaceships and, you know, basically a space opera or that kind of background in an MFA program, you probably have a hard time unless you go to one of the specialized programs like the Stone Coast non-resident MFA, which has people like James Patrick Kelly and Liz Hand and others as teachers. But I do think there's a lot more fiction being published now by, we'll call them mainstream writers that has fantastic elements in it. I mean, it's everywhere in our culture now. So, and they're, you know, best-selling novels that are written by, that have time travel in it, say, or, you know, an apocalyptic plague like Station 11 that kills off pretty much everybody. Things that would have been science fiction novels in 1960 now are published. And they're not really called science fiction, but they have the material of science fiction. They generally treat it a little different than a science fiction writer would as well. But if you're going to do spaceships and aliens, then you're still, I think, going to be put in a different pen.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting for me because I was asked this year to mentor an MFA student from the University of Saskatchewan, the first time I've done that. And he's writing a young adult fantasy novel. So I was pleased, in fact, that the University of Saskatchewan didn't seem to have a problem with people writing in those kinds of genres. So,
well, there are many more
interesting for me too.
There are many more professors and teachers in these programs who have genre credentials. So I think that it is a lot better now than it was in 1972.
So in between graduating from university and starting teaching at North Carolina State University, what were you doing in that interim there?
Well, I finished my coursework for the PhD. It must have been by 78 or something like that. And I was supposedly writing a dissertation, not very fast. I was writing stories. And I took a crack at being a full-time writer and didn't have much success at it, just writing short stories. So I got a job at a wire service as an editor, fortunate to get that. It was a very good job. For 3 years, I was a copy editor and then a news editor for a wire service called Commodity News Services out of Kansas City, which was half owned by Knight Ridder Newspapers and also by UPI, the United Press International Wire Service. And I learned an awful lot from that. That was very interesting work. So that was what I was doing while I was on the side trying to finish my dissertation. And then when I finished it and got my degree in 81, I looked for a teaching job because I found that as a wire service editor, it was very high pressure work. I was editing text all day, and I didn't feel like writing when I got home. So I thought, well, if I get a teaching job, I can have the summers off at the very least, and my schedule during the week won't have to be sitting in an office from 8 to 5 every day, doing high pressure work. So. And I was fortunate enough to get the job at NC State, and I came here in fall of 82.
And been there ever since.
Been there ever since, yeah.
Were your first sales then along in there somewhere, short fiction sales?
My first fiction sale was in 1975 to an anthology called Black Holes that they paid me for the story, but it never came out because the publisher went under. It was, as so many young writers, often you're selling to marginal markets. You can't get into the top paying market. So you're just trying to get in somewhere. And actually, that happened in my first three stories. I sold them to markets that folded before the stories came out.
Starts to make you a little paranoid.
Yeah, I began to feel pretty discouraged. But then it was in the late, I think it was in the 70s, 77, I sold a story to Galileo. And then I also sold one to Fantasy and Science Fiction a month apart. And what happened was a bunch of stories I had written already sold then one after another. And so if I said 80s earlier, I mean the late 70s is when I really started to break in. So 77, 78, 79, I started to see stories come out.
And then, of course, you mentioned you won the Nebula in 82.
Right, which was a huge shock. I was the first time I was nominated, and I was a complete unknown, and I think was quite shocking to people that I won. And, of course, the story was – it showed my background because it's a story about – your listeners may not know. It's about a commodities broker who wakes up on page one, and he's on a sailing ship, and he doesn't know how he got there. And it turns out – it's the Pequod, and he's in the middle of Moby Dick. And he had read it, and he had to read it in college, and he, you know, knows that at the end everybody dies except Ishmael, and he's not Ishmael. So that was my premise, and it used my literary study, because I'm a huge Herman Melville fan, but also it had this sort of fantasy element, and it also used my commodities editing knowledge. So it was really came out of a lot of things that were going on in my life. I wrote it in 1979 and 80, and it came out in fall of 81 and won the award in 82.
Have you mentioned the commodities feeding into that story? Has your astrophysics background played into any of your science fiction writing over the years?
Certainly, I know a lot of astronomy, and I try to get the science accurate. I know physics, and I'm not any kind of genius at it, but I know basic physics. And so when I'm doing science fiction stories, I do try to make it as plausible as I can. But I'm not afraid to violate fundamental laws of nature in order to write a story. And I'm not considered really a techie writer. I think I'm more considered a literary science fiction writer. And then I write stories that I think are of as fantasies, that they're not and when I say that, everyone thinks, oh, it's like Game of Thrones, castles, dragons, you know, lords and ladies. I've never written a story of that sort in my entire career. What I mean by fantasy is a story that violates reality. It has some element of the fantastic in it. Could be set in the present, the past. But it's not explained by appeal to science. So,
well, we're going to talk about your creative process using Pride and Prometheus as sort of a template for how you work. But I also wanted to ask you before we did that about, I noted that you had written a play, Faust Feathers. Yeah. Have you done other playwriting? I've done some playwriting, and I'm a professional actor. So I'm always curious in that sort of thing. So have you done a lot of playwriting?
I have done some playwriting. I wrote a one act back in the late 80s called A Clean Escape, based on a short story I wrote that was performed here in Raleigh. And I was very pleased to see that happen. And later on, I adapted it for a thing called the Seeing Ear Theater, which is an audio play thing run by the Sci-Fi Channel. And then I wrote Faust Feathers, which was won the Paul Green Prize. And it got produced somewhere in Nebraska, but I never got to see it. The Clean Escape actually eventually got adapted for that show, Masters of Science Fiction. So I have written some plays, and I did take an acting class, I'm in a couple of movies. I'm in a low budget movie called The Delicate Art of the Rifle. It's kind of typecasting. I play an obnoxious college professor who gets murdered. So I've done a little bit of that stuff, but mostly I've stuck to prose fiction.
I'm always interested in the crossover between fiction and plays, because they are very different kinds of writing. In the play world, of course, it's very much dialogue driven.
Right. It's very much – that's the case. But there's also when you're writing, you have to cast yourself into the mind of a character who may not be like you in order to write a book. And it seems to me that's what actors do. The idea that you're portraying someone who's not you, but you have to make their behavior rational and to act in a way that they would act. but somehow make it your own. And that to me is a kind of mental trick that writers do as well as actors.
Yeah, I often make that point when I'm talking with people about the two things. All right, well, let's move on to Pride and Prometheus. And before we get into talking about how it all came about and your creative writing process, maybe a synopsis and what the book is. I've not quite finished it, but I've read most of it. So.
Well, it's a it's a kind of a crossbreed. I've written a number of stories over the course of my career where I will use characters or situations created by other authors. Well, Another Orphan, which won the Nebula, which puts my character into Moby Dick. In this story, I'm basically crossing Frankenstein with Jane Austen's characters from Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. And this kind of story really appeals to me in that, in a way, it's a way of sort of thinking about the story and the characters the way maybe a literary critic might do it. But instead of doing it in terms of literary analysis, I just want to see, you know, what sorts of situations would happen. I got the idea for the story from a workshop where we were reading a story by a writer named Benjamin Rosenbaum, a wonderful writer, who had a story that was a parody of Jane Austen. And it occurred to me as I was talking about this story there at the workshop that Jane Austen and Mary Shelley were contemporaries. They were, if you went to a bookstore in 1818 in London, you could find Jane Austen's novels, Pride and Prejudice, on the shelf next to Frankenstein. And yet they're very, very different books. And I never, as an English professor, very seldom ever heard anyone talk about Mary Shelley and Jane Austen in the same context. Now I think they do a lot more, but not back then. And so, I thought, well, they're so different. I mean, putting a Jane Austen character in Frankenstein, that doesn't work. I mean, it can't. That kind of character, what would they do in Frankenstein? And then putting one of, Victor Frankenstein or the monster into a Jane Austen setting, they don't belong in a ballroom, okay? But that, to me, intrigued me. And so I got carried out. And I wrote originally a novelette version of this. I took the character of Mary Bennet from Pride and Prejudice and imagined her a decade or more after the end of that book and had her meet Victor Frankenstein and eventually meet his monster.
Yeah. And I guess it's hard to synopsize it without sort of.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's, you know, Mary is she's the old maid character, the middle sister in Pride and Prejudice, who's really not very attractive. She's kind of bookish and moralistic. She's always preaching to other people. And in Pride and Prejudice, she's hardly even in the book. And when she's there, she's sort of the butt of the joke. She's the only one of the Bennet sisters who's not pretty. If you know Jane Austen's books, they're almost all about finding the right mate and marrying. And I imagine that Mary is going to have a hard time of that. So I imagined her as, 32 years old and on the brink of old maiddom. And she gets dragged to a ball by her mother and her younger sister, Kitty, who's still trying to get married. And there she meets Victor Frankenstein, who is in England. She doesn't know this, but in Frankenstein, Victor goes to England. After he's created the monster, monster gets abandoned by him and has a terrible time of it and becomes very alienated and eventually finds out that Victor created him and goes to Victor's home and strangles his younger brother and then threatens Victor with killing everyone in his family if Victor does not create a mate for him. Since no human being will have anything to do with him, he needs to have someone to give him solace. And so he forces Victor to agree to make a female creature. And so Victor travels to England with his friend Henry. This is all in Frankenstein, and travels around and eventually goes up to Scotland on an island to create the female, the bride of the monster. And so my story begins where Mary's at this ball in London and Victor's there with his friend Henry. Henry drags him to the ball and they dance together and strike up a conversation and it turns out they like each other. And so that's the beginning of it. And the rest of it, it sort of follows Mary's encounters with Victor. Victor is being tormented by the fact the monster is following him. And then the monster is desperate to have Victor follow through on his promise. And the story alternates between the points of view of these three characters. It's mostly Mary's point of view, but it's also in Victor's point of view and also in the monster's point of view, which in Frankenstein, that's true too. If you've read it, both Victor and the creature, his creature, get to have their own points of view.
Yes, well, it was one reason it was interesting. I mean, I've read a little Jane Austen, but I've read Frankenstein twice, and I think I read it for the first time. And you mentioned this in an interview somewhere that it was Brian W. Aldiss who perhaps first suggested that Frankenstein was the first science fiction novel. And it was after reading his history of the field that I thought I should read Frankenstein as opposed to just relying on what we all kind of know from the miasma of Frankenstein stuff that's
right,
around.
Right. And frankly, the image we get of Frankenstein from movies is very much not the creature that we, well, one thing that people call the monster Frankenstein is Victor, is Frankenstein. Yeah. The creature has no name in the book. Yes, I wanted to present the monster, the creature, I prefer to call him a creature, as he is in the novel. He's incredibly intelligent. He's agile. He's strong. Becomes a kind of, he educates himself remarkably. He's incredibly articulate. He speaks very well, which is so weird because we're not used to that from the movies. And so one of the things that Victor warns people against when he tells them about this creature is don't listen to him because he's so persuasive. I thought that's really interesting. And he's sort of a social critic of human behavior. So I wanted to get into that in a way. Aldiss did say that this was the first science fiction book, and I had not read it until I read Aldiss back in the 70s. And it seemed to me that if Mary Shelley's wrote the first true science fiction novel in English, and Jane Austen was sort of the ancestor of the novel of manners. So these are the two great streams in literature, it seems to me, since the early 1800s to the present. So we have the novel of the fantastic, the science fiction novel, and then we have the realistic novel like Henry James and Virginia Woolf followed in the footsteps of Jane Austen. And so in a way, cramming these two things together in the same book is really sort of unnatural, but also, to me, fascinating.
I read it again. I read it out loud to my wife for the 150th anniversary of the novel because I read out loud while she's cooking because our kitchen's too small for us to cook side by side. Uh-huh. And so it was very interesting to read it out loud, too, and to say that that sort of early 19th century prose.
Right.
And also the fact that, Mary Shelley was a teenager when she wrote it, 19.
Really? 18, 19 years old. Yeah. And I think it was published when she just turned 20, right?
And I have a daughter who's 18, so.
Oh, okay. Actually, it was 200 years ago. 200 years ago in 1818.
Oh, right, 200, yeah. I've just lost half a century there somewhere. Yeah. So you've talked about how the inspiration for this came about. Just pulling back from it a little bit, is that fairly typical of the way that your story ideas come to you, things sort of colliding and sparks coming off of it?
Often the collision of two things that don't fit together is a good way to get a story started, it seems to me. But and I've written a number of works, as I say, that take off from other literary works. But that's not all the stuff I write. And so like my last novel in 2017 before this one was The Moon and the Other, which is a science fiction novel set on the moon in the 22nd century and very complex future background, lots of technology. I tried to make it as accurate as I could, showing how people might live on the moon. So that one really comes from a different place. And that's sort of how it works, really. But yes, the collision of things, to me, it's always interesting to have things that don't seem like they ought to go together, put together. Or another way of putting that is I really like paradoxes. I like when things don't easily settle themselves out, where all of the for instance, all the morality or the rightness and wrongness doesn't all land on one side. I don't really like stories where there's the hero and the villain and there's just no it's easy to choose between them, and there's no confusion or complication of that way of seeing things.
So once you have the idea for this novel or other novels, what does your planning process look like? Do you do a detailed outline, and how does it differ from your short fiction writing?
Well, again, it depends a little bit on the project. With novels, I do quite a bit of outlining and sketches and notes. I will try to figure out, you know, what the inciting incident is, the beginning incident, and then have some sense of where it's going in the end. Although when I was younger, I always had to know the ending before I could start a story. But now I'm more willing to get started without a firm idea of how it's going to end. Well, one thing with Pride and Prometheus is I had many things given to me from Frankenstein. Okay, mm-hmm. I knew I was going to follow Frankenstein's plot. And so I know that eventually that Victor ends up in the Orkney Islands. They're trying to create the female. So that, to me, was a place I was going to get to. I knew I was going to get up in the Orkney Islands when he's trying to create the bride for the monster. How he gets there and how Mary gets involved in it, was not all worked out. But then those things are also given to you. For instance, one of the things that happened was, I think I mentioned that in Jane Austen's novels, spring for many of the plots, or maybe all the plots, is finding the right mate. You have these young women heroines who are maybe attracted to one man or someone is being courted by one man, but it turns out there's someone else who's really the person they should be with. And finding the right mate is the crucial decision of a young woman's life in Jane Austen's period, of her social class anyway. And so what hit me was that in Frankenstein is about a lonely guy, the creature who can't find a mate. And so he has to find a female who will love him. And then Victor's part in this is he has to create this female. And in order to do that, he's going to have to come up with a female body. So I thought, well, gosh, that's sort of scary. He's going to meet my character, Mary, and who's a lonely old maid, and what sorts of things could happen. And so this sort of offers certain possibilities of scenes that I could imagine. And if you have certain scenes you want to write in a narrative, you can connect the dots, really, like beads on a string. I know I'm driving from here to San Francisco, and I know I'm going to stop in Memphis and Kansas City and Denver and Salt Lake City, but I don't know where I'm going in between. And so you sort of try to arrange those, and you drive your characters. You know your characters. You know what they're what they want and what they don't want. The circumstances around them, circumstances will change, but depending on what happens in the story. And then you given who they are, the kind of people they are, how would they react to that, and what would they do to respond to it? And so that can help you plot a story out. That seems to me a pretty natural way to create a story.
One of the interesting things about Pride and Prometheus is you've got this Jane Austen, and it's three viewpoints. I guess there's a third person for Mary, and then you've got two first persons. You've got the creature, and you've got Frankenstein, and all of them. It's the prose is. It seems to me that it reminds you of the prose of Austen and Shelley without being trying to really get into that very convoluted early 19th century style where you can have one sentence that goes on for like a full page almost.
Right. Well, thank you. I actually spent a lot of time thinking about that. And so I tried not to completely imitate Jane Austen's or Mary Shelley's styles, which are quite different. And it's right. And, Frankenstein is written in first person from the point of view of these characters. And Jane Austen's novels are all in third person. But I wanted to allude to them so that someone who is familiar with those books would feel that this was reminiscent of that without being so convoluted that it would be difficult to read. So that was my take on it. I hope I did that well enough. I'm pretty proud of how I did it, actually. In a lot of ways, writing a book is a process of discovery. And you have to, I've said this to my students, that when you write any fiction, that it's a collaboration between your conscious mind and your unconscious mind. And if you have everything planned out like a, you know, an architect, it seems to me you can stifle your imagination because you have everything all worked out and there's no discovery involved. So I think that you have to depend on, at least the life of a narrative can come from you allowing your mind to ruminate over something that you don't really know the answer to. And Jim Kelly, my friend James Patrick Kelly, says that if the writer writing a story is never surprised by anything that happens, then no reader will ever be surprised. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that, you know, to a greater or lesser degree, that there have to be things that you didn't plan that turn up on the page. I don't know what your experience is, but haven't you ever had the experience where something just sort of comes to you as you're writing that is exactly the thing you needed and you did not know it, but there it is, and it proves to be much smarter than anything you could have thought up in advance?
Oh yeah, that happens all the time. Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny how that works. It seems to me that our minds are more complex than we can easily understand.
As I, the book I'm writing now, which is the third book in a series of mine, much to my surprise, there's this long discussion on God's relationship to time that pops up in one scene, which I had no intention of the two characters talking about at that time, but that just seemed to make sense. And so there it is so far anyway. So yeah, it's interesting. It's very interesting the way the writing mind works. What's your actual physical process of writing? Did you write this in longhand in a notebook like they might have Austin and Shelley, or do you write on the computer? Or how do you work?
I'm a computer writer, keyboard writer. I've been writing on keyboards since, 1970 with typewriters. Mm-hmm. I've done some longhand writing, but very little, very little. And I know some writers who say that they can't think unless they're writing longhand, but I work with a keyboard. I work with a laptop right now, although I have it connected to a big screen at my desk. And I tend to work at my desk in my home office. Although there have been times when I'm having trouble, I will say, okay, I'm going to go to Panera Bread or Starbucks and sit there in the corner and try to write. And that's worked too. So whatever it takes to get the work done, I think, is what I need. And when I'm teaching, I have a lot of other responsibilities, so I can't always write every day. And I'm not one of those. Actually, I think one of the things that's told to young writers that can be very intimidating to them is that you can't be a writer unless you write every day. And it seems to me that it's certainly good to encourage the habit of writing regularly. Okay, I think that that's absolutely true. If you want to write anything of any length, or you need to have your head in the game regularly, all the time. But I don't write every day, and I never have. And there have been periods where I've written every day for a couple of months when I've had the time to do that, or when I've been hot on a project and I want to finish it. But there are other times when I'll write 3 days a week, okay, or I'll, between projects, be sitting around reading and playing the guitar and watching bad movies and thinking. And that my process, I do have habits that work for me. I try to be regular in them, but other people say, you have to write the same time of day every day. Well, I generally will try to work in the morning, but it doesn't always work that way. So whenever it comes to me to work, then I will work. And sometimes I do have to kick myself in the pants and say, okay, you need to sit down there. You need to close the door. You need to stare at the screen. You can't look at your email. You cannot go to Facebook. You are a writer.
Yeah. Yeah. I know that feeling. Deadlines help sometimes too.
I like deadlines. Motivation. Actually, I know George R. R. Martin, I think, is a writer who hates deadlines and is sort of fights against them. I am one who deadline focuses my attention. And I like deadlines because it tells me exactly what I have to do. If I have this done by September 1st, it'll be done by September 1st. In my entire undergraduate career and graduate career, I don't think I ever turned in a paper late. because something about it, the idea of being late on it would be worse. I mean, I just would, it, not so much that I'd get a bad grade, but rather that psychologically, I might never get it done if I don't make it by the date that I'm supposed to turn it in.
What does your, once you have a draft, what does your revision process look like?
Well, I will certainly go over it and make sure it reads smoothly and, you know, revise and edit to a degree until I've got a fairly polished version of it. But then I will show it to other people who are writers who I trust to give me feedback. And one of them is my wife, Therese Ann Fowler, who is extremely successful. Right? I mean, she's much more successful than I am. She wrote a novel called Z, a novel of Zelda Fitzgerald, which was a bestseller and was made into a TV show on Amazon. And so she's a very experienced novelist. And so she gives me feedback. And I often talk to her about it over supper. We'll be working during the, we're both writers. And so we're working and then we, you know, have meals together and, how's your day, dear? Oh, you know, and she doesn't talk as much about her work as I do, but I often talk about what I'm doing and what the problems are and what's going on. But then when I get a draft done, I show it to her. I always ask James Patrick Kelly to read it, and he has been my faithful critiquer and critic for, you know, 40 years now, really, and very wonderful guy, wonderful writer, so knowledgeable. Other writers who I have regularly had feedback. My friend Richard Butner, who lives here in Raleigh, and Lewis Shiner, well-known science fiction writer. He lives here in Raleigh, and we've been friends for more than 30 years. Karen Joy Fowler has helped me a lot with my female characters. And Gregory Frost. And, you know, often actually for a couple of my things, Bruce Sterling, a writer who many people, I mean, back in the 80s when he was the head cyberpunk and I was labeled as a humanist writer, people thought we would, you know, we hated each other, but that wasn't the case. And even though we disagreed about an awful lot of stuff, but he's given me some very good readings over the years.
Are there sort of consistent things you find that your readers come back with that you need to perk up?
I usually find when I have some women readers that my women characters need attention. Okay. And so I'm trying to do my best, but you know, I think it's good to have someone put their eyes on it who has experienced the things that a woman experiences. And so that to me is a consistent thing that I have had to pay attention to. The editing of editing things down, I tend to be in my early drafts a lot more wordy than I do in the later. And as I've gotten older, I'm less and less that way, I think. And Jim Kelly has been very helpful with that. He's a much more efficient writer than I am. And I have sort of worked to get to that point. What other things? You know, there's sometimes story logic issues or... But generally, my stories, when I get a draft done, I've done a lot of time thinking. I don't write really fast. So it generally has had a lot of thought put into it. And it's very seldom that I get told something that causes me to drastically change what I've written, like the structure or something.
You teach writing. Do you ever find people telling you to do things that, you know, you tell your students to do, but you overlook in your own writing?
Gosh, probably. One of my colleagues at NC State is a novelist named Wilton Barnhart, also a wonderful novelist, who's given me much, much good advice. He's not afraid to tell me, you know, but I think as far as the things that I tell my students, it's not usually so much that, you know.
Well, I ask because, you know, I mentor writers, and then when I'm editing my own stuff, I'll say, you know, there it is. That's exactly what I told them not to do, and I did it in my first draft.
Well, there's certainly true that I will make grammar or usage errors that I would complain about to them. I generally know the difference between lie and lay, okay, but it's possible for me to make a mistake there, or I will sometimes put an apostrophe in its when it's a possessive it's when it doesn't belong there.
Yeah, so that's a pernicious one. I don't know. That just happens sometimes.
Right. It's you know, it's a matter of you writing fast and not thinking. So
once the book goes to the publisher, what does the editing, you were, we should say Pride and Prometheus is from Saga, is that right?
Saga, that's right. Saga, yeah. And my previous book, The Moon and the Other, was also from Saga. And that was, my editor there is Joe Monti, who's good. I had never worked with him before, The Moon and the Other. And actually, I said that I very seldom change structure, but with The Moon and the Other, I sold him the book. You know, he had the whole manuscript. It was finished, before. I mean, I thought it was done. And he read it, and we met in New York City, and he said, you know, it's a slow start on this book. It's a big book. It's like 600 pages long, and it's got four main characters, and it alternates point of view between these four characters. And I said, yeah, I know it starts really slow because I have to introduce all four characters and they're in different places. They don't know each other. It's complicated. And he said, do you know how long it takes before all four characters are introduced? And I said, geez, I don't know, maybe 80 pages, 70 pages. He says, 108 pages. I thought, wow. Okay. And he said, is there something you can do? I mean, he said, also the first chapter originally was taking place 10 years before the body of the book. It was sort of like a prologue. And he said, do you have to have that chapter? Can you take it out? And I said, I absolutely cannot take out that chapter because it mirrors the last chapter of the book. And there are all these reasons why I just could not do it. There are too many things introduced there that are vital to the storyline. And then I went home and I said, okay, so he said, he didn't say I had to do it, but he said, is there anything you do to speed up this book? And so I went home and I thought, well, all right, is it possible to take out that first chapter? What happens if I take out the first chapter? There's things in that chapter I absolutely need. Is there someplace else I could put them? So I took the first chapter out, and one thing immediately became evident is that I would have to rearrange the order of the next six or seven chapters. And so I did that. And then I had to rearrange what was in those chapters because the chapters depended on what happened in previous chapters. And then I had to get the first chapter stuff in there somewhere else. And anyway, it ended up changing the first seven chapters of the book and considerable revision. And it got much better. I mean, it started much better. And I'm so glad he didn't tell me to do it. He didn't say you have to do this, but he made me think about it. And it really was vitally important to the book, I think, to do it, to get that chapter moved. And it really made it better.
And I think, new writers sometimes are concerned about the editing process. You know, they're going to change my deathless prose and all that sort of thing.
Right, right.
And certainly my experience has been with my editors, Sheila E. Gilbert at Daw Books, Hugo Award-winning editor. And my experience has been editors make things better for the most part.
I think they want the book to be as good as it can be. And, you know, you may have some differences of opinion, but it doesn't help you to be stiff-necked and defensive about things. You know, actually, Christopher, who was in my undergraduate class, was writing the novel. I can't remember the title of the first novel in the series. He had it in my parts of it in my class. And I remember we met in my office one time and it had a prologue on it. And I felt the prologue was slow to start, and then the first chapter was a completely different situation than the prologue. And I said, okay, so you're opening the story with a frame here. When do you close the frame? Do you close the frame at the end of the book? Because I hadn't seen the whole book. He said, no, I close the frame at the end of the trilogy. And I said, that's not going to work. If you're going to have a frame in front of a book, you need to close it by the end of the book, or at least that's my strong prejudice. Or think about that, okay? And so what he did was he ended up throwing it out. And I don't know what he did with the material if it shows up elsewhere, but he changed that. And to me, I thought that was I didn't make him do it, but I just was my advice for a better opening. And it's funny, it's similar to what Joe Monti told me. Although it happened before that. So, I guess it helps to be able to listen to things, even if you don't in the end do what the editor says.
Empire Silence, that's the first book.
That's it, Empire Silence.
Howling Dark is the second one that just came out. Well, now we're getting close to the end, so I want to move to the big philosophical questions. Why do you write? Why do you think any of us write? And why do you and I and others write science fiction and fantasy?
Wow, those are tough questions. I don't know if I can speak for everyone else, but...
Well, for yourself, then.
Yeah. Frederick Pohl, science fiction writer Frederick Pohl, said, science fiction is a way of thinking about things. And I like that definition a lot. It seems to me that you can think about things in terms of, in science fictional terms, the same kind of things you could think about in a realistic story, but you do it differently. So if you think about, say, marriage, okay, or death or love or parenthood or something like that, in science fiction, you can twist things in a way that sort of exposes the workings, or I think of it sometimes as like a lever that you can shove into the machine and pry it open and see the workings in a different way than a realistic novelist or story writer can. So that's one of the appeals of science fiction, is that you can... The fantastic element to me should be essential to the story. And in fact, that's one of my principles, is that if I could tell this story without the science fiction or the fantasy element, then I should tell it without it. Okay. That has to be vital to the story. It has to be essential to make the point I'm trying to make, that is in there. In other words, The Moon and the Other started from me watching my daughter at the daycare center when she was a toddler. And I was watching the kids in the playground, little kids, 2-3 years old, playing out back. And it seemed to me that the boys' way of playing was different from the girls' way of playing. And I started thinking about, well, is that inherent or is this culturally determined? Okay, when did they start behaving differently? And so that got me thinking about the difference between men and women. Not that I hadn't thought about it before, but I ended up writing this big novel set on the moon in the 27th century about gender issues. And yet another person would have written a story about a father at a daycare center with his daughter and the other kids, you see, but that's not what I wrote. I wrote a science fiction novel. So there's something about that tropism for the strange or the fantastic that I've always had. And I think I always will. I think that, why does anyone write? It's a very good question. I think it's something about trying to figure out the world, it seems to me. Or maybe just to entertain yourself or entertain somebody. You want to, there's an element also of sort of showing off, isn't there? where you want to everyone to admire you. And so I remember there was a TV production company that did sitcoms and stuff. And at the end of every show, they'd have this little logo and they'd have a kid's voice that would say, "I made this." And I always liked that because a kid makes things just to make them. And to be proud, to sort of say, "I made this myself. No one else made this." And I still have that kid feeling, no one else wrote these books. No one else could write these books exactly the way I wrote them. And they maybe for better or for worse, someone might have written them better. But I made this book myself. And I like that,
Yeah, I think that is one of the rewarding things about it, for sure. Well,
it's bad when they reject your story and say, "Oh my God, that stinks."
Yeah, there's that too.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of the end of our time. So what are you working on now?
I have a novella that I just told you about that is on submission right now that is a weird kind of thing. It's about the assassination of President William McKinley in 1901 at a World's Fair in Buffalo, New York. And it's also about a trip to the moon in 1901. And it sort of alternates between the realistic historical story and this fantastic scientific romance about the inhabited moon full of selenites.
And I missed that moon.
Yeah, it's based on a ride that was there at the fair called A Trip to the Moon. It was the first dark ride. If you know what a dark ride is, like at Universal City or Disney World, where they have these rides, you're in a vehicle and they show you things. So that one's going out. It's sort of a political story. I got a ghost story. I wrote my first ghost story that is on submission right now. And I don't know. We'll see what happens with that. You'd think I would have written a ghost story before now, but I didn't. And who knows? I like to write different kinds of stories. So, you know, if there's a kind of story I haven't written yet, I'm thinking, well, what kind of monster story would I write?
And where can people find you online?
Oh, I have a website, and I can't remember the web address, but if you Google me, you'll find my my webpage. And I have a pretty active a Facebook page, which is open to the public and has lots of things on there. You can find things about me. And I'm in the bookstores. Look for Saga Books.
Okay. Well, I think that's the end of our time. So thanks so much for being a guest on The World Shapers. That was a fun conversation.
Well, thank you very much. I certainly didn't lack for things to say. I hope I didn't get too far off the bat.
No, that was great. So thanks a lot, and bye for now.
Take care.
So thanks again to John Kessel for being my guest on this episode of The World Shapers. That was a great chat. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Just a reminder that The World Shapers is online at theworldshapers.com. That's the website. You can find it on Twitter at The World Shapers. And you can find it on Facebook at The World Shapers. Google The World Shapers podcast. You should find it without any trouble. I am also online, of course, as you might expect. You can find me at edwardwillett.com, edwardwillett.com. You can find me on Twitter at ewillett, ewillett. And you can find me on Facebook at edward.willett. You can also find me on Instagram, but I'm not very active there. I still haven't quite figured out how to make that one work for me, but I am on there if you want to check it out. That's another episode of The World Shapers, and many more great episodes to come. I've lined up quite a few guests that I'll be talking to in a very short order here. There's Elisa Kessler, who's a paranormal romance writer, so that's a little different. She's coming up next. After that, we've got people like Tim Pratt, Susan J. Forrest, Garth Nix, very excited about that one. James Allen Gardner, Candace Jane Dorsey. I may be forgetting somebody, but there's some great guests still to come. And I hope you will come back and listen to all of these episodes and also go back and check out on the worldshapers.com website, the archives, where you can go back and listen to the first year's worth of interviews, because I've just gone past the year anniversary at the beginning of August. It's been a great year of talking to writers, and there are many more great talks with writers to come. So please do come back and enjoy more of The World Shapers. That's it for this week. Bye for now.